Bitcoin is a lot more than gold. Bitcoin is a lot more than just a store of value. It's this security apparatus. It's the monetary protocol for the internet. You know, Jack Dorsey recently said, you know, he thinks by 2030, everyone transacting everything will be on, you know, on the internet will be on Bitcoin. You know, when Paul Tudor Jones says Bitcoin is the fastest horse, I think that's right.
Welcome to the Swan Signal Podcast, a production of Swan Bitcoin, the best way to accumulate Bitcoin with automatic recurring buys at swanbitcoin.com. I'm your host, Brady Swenson, head of education at Swan. Swan Signal Live pairs great guests for compelling discussions about Bitcoin and economics. In this one, Dan Tapiero, founder of DTAP Capital, and Dan Matuszewski, founder of CMS Holdings, join us. Glad you found your way here. Enjoy. Hey, everyone, and welcome back to Swan Signal Live. This is a production of Swan Bitcoin at swanbitcoin.com. We have a great show for you today. I think it's a very intriguing pairing. It should be a fantastic conversation between Dan Matuszewski and Dan Tapiero. We're going to go with Dan M and Dan T throughout this episode. We have the two Dans on right now. Before we jump in, we're going to take a quick look at what we're doing here at Swan. We built the safest way to accumulate Bitcoin with automatic recurring buys. You can be confident when you send your friends and family to Swan that we will treat them well. We're laser focused on accumulating Bitcoin for the long term. No distractions from altcoins or trading. We're dedicated to Bitcoin education in our effort to help your family and friends become confident hodlers. Before you do start sending them our way, though, enlist in our referral program, SwanForce, at swanbitcoin.com/enlist, and you'll stack 25% of Swan's fees on all of their purchases for 3 years. You can stack some meaningful sats that way for sure, and your friends and family will get $10 of Bitcoin dropped into their accounts when they start stacking. All right, let's get into this one. Dan Matuszewski, the principal and co-founder of CMS Holdings. He is the former head of Circle Trade, and before that, he was on the early Kraken team. Dan, welcome to the show, man.
Thanks, glad to be here.
All right, and then we have, of course, Dan Tapiero. He's a well-known global macro investor, co-founder of 10T Holdings and Gold Bullion International, and the founder of DTAP Capital. Really great to have you on, Dan. Thanks for being here.
Nice to be here.
All right. Brecky, we're going to kick off this show by rolling a video, actually. It's a hype video that dropped earlier this month. I thought we'd get everybody hyped up and excited. And then we'll roll into this one. Brecky, can you roll tape on that?
Can you characterize everything that the Fed has done this past week as essentially flooding the system with money?
Yes, exactly.
And there's no end to your ability to do that?
There is no end to our ability to do that.
And we believe that achieving inflation that averages 2% over time helps ensure that longer-term inflation expectations remain well-anchored at our longer-run 2% objective.
Exactly. I would bet even in 5 or 6 years, I'm no longer talking about Bitcoin as Treasury Secretary. I'll have other priorities.
You'll be loaded up on Bitcoin and have been a gazillionaire.
I can assure you I will personally not be loaded up on Bitcoin.
Okay. Never say never.
If from a purchasing power standpoint, if you own cash in the world today, you know your central bank has an avowed goal of depreciating its value 2% per year. So you have, in essence, a wasting asset in your hand. So Bitcoin, I think it's a great speculation.
All right, that was fun. I feel like I'm at a pro sporting event, and I'm ready for the team to come out. And so the team here today is of course Dan M and Dan T. Guys, I'm going to start with you, Dan T. It's been quite a year for Bitcoin. All right, that video showed us a lot of I would say surprising developments for Bitcoin this year. Of course, starting out with the very big shift in the macro environment due to the economic shutdowns. So I'm just like to kick off with talking about what for you is the most surprising story for Bitcoin this year.
Most surprising?
Yeah, most surprising, unexpected for you.
Look, I don't know that there's that much That's surprising. We had the wipeout in March, and I thought that was pretty much of a gift to get right back to the near the levels, the lows of last. With a macro backdrop, rates at zero, the economy impaired for a while. I think the end of fixed income, or at least government bonds as a proper or functioning asset class, all the things that happened this year pretty much were supportive. I don't want to say that, I don't want to be disappointed in the price movement. I think 10,000, 11,000 is a great place to be. I think, just the other day, I saw that, for this time of year, this is the all-time high. If you go back and, let's say this is September 30th of last year versus September 30th the previous year, record number of days over 10,000. I think everything is sort of according to plan, going well. I don't, macro backdrop just became supportive, more supportive. And if you want to be surprised by anything, I guess, you could say, oh, the price should be higher, but I don't think you play that game with Bitcoin. I think you own it and you sit with it and you're patient and, it'll do what it's going to do when it's going to do it.
Yep. Being patient is absolutely key, of course. Dan M, did you have anything surprise you this year? There's several events I think you could point at. One in particular that I'm going to bring up if neither of you guys do.
Surprise-wise, I think the biggest thing that surprised me market-wise is the stickiness of the equity correlation post-March, right? Like, when the world was falling apart and like everything was like just getting like grabbed for liquidity, like it made sense. Like I got it. Like the world goes to zero at the same time. Like everything's beta one, but it's like really persisted post. And like I get the recovery aspect of it and like sort of all that mania. But I mean, we're like 3 or 4 months out of that now, and it's still been pretty tightly correlated to equities, larger than it used to be. Like it's not like a 1-for-1 lockstep anymore, but it's definitely a lot higher than it was pre. And I don't know if that's like the new normal or what's going on with that. I don't know if that's like any indication that there's larger institutional participation on like the trading side, like CME's grown. Maybe that's why it's like sticking, but that's been a little shocking to me. Mostly because I thought Bitcoin would be far bigger before it had such a like persistent correlation to larger macro markets. So it's happening a little sooner than I sort of predicted. The other thing is just like the vol has been very low post-March, like, and especially the last couple months. Like it has been exceptionally low, in my opinion. Like implieds right now are like low 40s. I think that's pretty kind of crazy given what's going on in the macro backdrop. Yet Bitcoin is like somehow shaking that off. So those are the two big things that I've seen. I mean, like also like we had the halving and that like sort of seemed to be like a non-event to people. Not that it won't have structural differences in supply demand imbalances going forward, but I don't know, like that whole thing happening sort of very quickly, quietly. I feel like we don't even talk about it anymore, but yeah, that would be the big things I see from the market.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what do you guys think about the MicroStrategy news? Did you think that we'd see a, major public corporation take Bitcoin in as a reserve asset, Dan T?
Well, I mean, I guess you could say that was a little surprising, but I think we've all sort of been waiting for that. I think the degree he's put on, especially relative to his company size, I mean, it's a very gutsy move. I certainly applaud it. I mean, we're all impressed with how quickly he's come along. I mean, probably a year ago, he was nowhere near where he is today. And I like, when you read the statement, I like the analytical framework that he used to get himself there. The Paul Tudor Jones piece was very important this year, but Paul was still, I think, looking at Bitcoin through a little bit of an old lens, the old global macro framework. And, he still calls it a speculation. It acts a little bit as a hedge for him. Saylor sort of takes it to the next level and says, I love it. I own it. I'm here big. I'm not selling. it's the new standard. And I think he's very, very early. The world that I'm from, you know, where there are older guys and more sort of asset allocation people, older portfolio managers, and then CEOs of big corporations, they're nowhere near that. But look, there always has to be a first. And I think he's a great spokesperson, and he's got tremendous passion. So I'm thrilled that he's done it.
Yeah, I think that's what surprised me about it was that, you know, he went in and called it a Bitcoin standard, a corporate Bitcoin standard. And I mean, putting Bitcoin on your balance sheet, yeah, I think we expected that to happen with some corporations coming up, you know, sometime in the nearest future. But, you know, the way that he went in, the size and the absolute conviction that he developed in a short time in Bitcoin was surprising to me. Dan M., what's your thoughts on the MicroStrategy move?
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a material amount of that, like, corporate. I don't know what it was up offhand, but it's shockingly large when I, like, sort of looked at it in comparison to the size of them. Like, I don't think it really was shocking that a corporate, especially a U.S. public corporate, had put it on their balance sheet. Like, I thought it would have been like a Twitter or like a sort of a larger tech company that would have put a material amount, maybe even the same amount as the MicroStrategy dollar-wise was in, but their balance sheet would have been much larger, right? Like, it is very gutsy, sort of, as Dan T said, given that, I mean, look, Bitcoin's volatile. Like, it's very possible that, like, this doesn't work out great for the short term for him. So I don't know. I mean, it's very concentrated. That being said, like, I do think we'll see more of that. This is not the first time, I think. It's not going to be like a one and done, right? Like, I don't know if it'll be the same conviction level, but I could see there being some sort of allocation to it amongst specifically, like, tech companies. I think that's, like, where, like, the natural fit is.
Yeah, yeah. Dan T., you posted a tweet about the MicroStrategy news, and you included a table that had the top, or three of the top, I should say, investors in MicroStrategy, outside investors. One is BlackRock Fund. The other is the Vanguard Group. Obviously, two massive asset holders and fund managers in the United States, and then the Norwegian government pension fund. You pointed out as kind of an overlooked aspect of this news. Could you talk about why that might have been overlooked and why that could be significant moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, they don't have direct exposure, and maybe they weren't even aware. You know, I'm sure they're aware now. But, you know, it's very small exposure, but I think it's something. It's, you know, I thought, look, the Norwegians have been, you know, very cutting edge. They're a large sovereign wealth fund that other sovereign wealth funds follow. A lot of, you know, mega institutional people, fund managers follow them. And so, you know, I'm just thinking, look, if the Norwegians wake up and they say, hey, we own a chunk of this company. Look what they've done with all their cash. They own all this Bitcoin. What's that about? Let's put, you know, 10 research people on that and figure out what that's about. And, you know, these large organizations have almost unlimited capital or unlimited resources. And, you know, if you want to put 5 to 10 guys on this who are, you know, young guys and say, figure this out, is this something we should have 1 or 2% of our portfolio in? You're really gonna set off quite a storm, you know. Because look, for the Norwegians, that would be, what did we say? Are they? They're about a trillion, right? So that's a $10 billion position, and then you get other people following them, and then sort of that's the path to adoption. Now, I think that's still a bit of ways, but you know, it's a toe dip, and I think it's. You know, it's something that could happen. We could see in the next year or two.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely putting Bitcoin, if it wasn't already, I'm sure it was already, on the radars of these, you know, investors. And, you know, the Norwegian government's pension fund is over $1 trillion. BlackRock and Vanguard manage like $15 trillion combined. So that's the kind of size that we're looking at, you know, of companies that are, you know, being exposed to the idea of Bitcoin and watching it very closely, especially after this move from MicroStrategy. So the macro environment is, you know, changing quickly right now. There's a lot going on, a lot to watch. I'd love to hear, Dan T, from you, what you are watching right now and in the coming months to let us know or give us a little insight to what might be, you know, happening in the nearest future in the macro world.
Yeah, thanks. I think March, April, May, my shorter term vision was very clear. My focus has been Bitcoin and gold. A substantial part of everything I have is focused on those two things. And the move in the equity market also, I think it was relatively clear. You know, every central bank, almost every government of significance around the world added an unprecedented amount of liquidity, took rates to zero or negative in Europe and Japan, and it really is all hands on deck by the existing, the authorities, monetary authorities. And so that was very supportive. But, you know, we've had over 50% move up in the equity. We've had a nice move in Bitcoin and Ethereum. There's been a whole fire lit underneath the subsection of, the Bitcoin world. I mean, if you want, the DeFi has sort of exploded. Dan M probably should get into that. So, I mean, the liquidity conditions are very supportive. I would just say in the short term, and actually I thought we would have this big move into the election, primarily because Trump, has been, I don't want to say manipulative of the market, but, when it goes down, he's been very supportive. And if there was ever a time for him to be supportive, it's now. So I thought that was clear. I think the next 6 months to me are not as clear as they were in March. I mean, I could see consolidation. The gold price at 2000 ish could consolidate for months. I don't know. I think what is very clear, at least to me, is the long term. Again, March was short term and long term clear. But the long term is very clear because I think there has been a structural shift after COVID. I think work from home is semi-permanent. The move to everything sort of becoming digitized, companies being able to function remotely and in a decentralized way is totally new. Zero rates and extremely low rates on bonds has been something I've been focused on because, look, I mean, if you're a global macro guy in the 90s and 2000s, you made a vast chunk of your money in the drop in interest rates. And even if you're an equity fund manager or holder, the drop in the rates exploded the multiples. So everyone has benefited. And I think that trend is done. And so I've been saying that the most important trend of the 20s for asset allocators, money managers like myself, is what are you going to do with that portion of your portfolio that for the last 30 years has been in bonds? And, the traditional portfolio is 60-40 or 70-30. So that's equity or assets to bonds. And if you're holding 30% government bonds at, 50 basis points or 50 basis points, and you're a pension fund and you have liabilities, you're dead. And you got to get out. And one other thing is that the hedge portion of that old traditional portfolio, meaning that when you had a recession or things slowed down or the equities took a pause, you always had that fixed income to kick in for you. So that supported your portfolio. Now you don't have that. If things soften again, and in the next few years, we're likely to have another, some sort of softening, the bonds aren't going to go much below zero. And you're going to, in my view, the first thing people are going to go to is gold. Gold does have those hedge characteristics. And look, it's super liquid. I think eventually they'll go to Bitcoin too. But look, gold trades $50 trillion a year. It's a $12 trillion asset. Bitcoin is a $200 billion asset that trades $4 trillion, I think, the total cryptocurrency volume last year was $4 trillion. So if you're one of these large funds like the Norwegian Fund, and you're thinking about what do I do with the, you know, $50 to $100 trillion globally that's in fixed income, I think gold, and I think eventually you move to Bitcoin, and there are other alternative assets. But so that's why the long term for me, for the macro, is very clear. I think equities can also do better, but equities are going to get way more overvalued in the years to come, just because I just don't see any momentum for rates to go up and for them to stay at zero. So, I'd stop there. Sorry, Dan M. I went on a little bit there.
Don't worry about it.
All right.
This is what we brought you on the show for, man. Don't worry about, going long there. Dan M., what do you think, man? What do you see, future actions of the Fed or long term? Are we committed to this path at this point? What's the inevitable conclusion of this fiat money experiment in your mind?
Yeah, so I'll preface this all with, like, I don't follow it to the same level of granularity that Dan T does, mostly because I care about it in the context of crypto and Bitcoin, but Bitcoin in particular, like the factors that I see that moving in and around the timelines that we're trading in particular, like they're not as dictated by sort of those larger macro factors, but you still got to pay attention to it, right? Like I said, the correlations have been going up more and more, so it's becoming more and more of something we have to like pay attention to, which I sort of find unfortunate, but I think it's the reality of the asset class growing up. But anyway, I generally agree with what Dan T is saying, where I think you have just tremendous easing and like liquidity being pumped into the system that really pushes everybody at the risk curve, right? Like you see a movement from bonds to stocks and then like stocks to call it private equity to venture capital. Like it's just like everyone's bumping out in terms of like what their risk tolerance is because like they're getting no yield like further up that stack. So that naturally is going to like force money to flow into crypto. And like there's also just like the fact that it's expanding so quickly, like that money is going to like land in Bitcoin regardless. And I think in particular, like a lot of people will be like drawn to it potentially, like in gold in this like same like sort of framing is like there's always this argument like, well, like I can just get X for my money as interest. Like why would I put it in this thing that doesn't yield anything? But that doesn't really matter anymore because like nothing yields anything. So you're like, well, all right. So I guess it's not necessarily a like, oh, like I can get this fixed rate interest payment on it. First, like gold, which is giving me nothing, or Bitcoin, which is giving me nothing, to, oh, like I can actually just like treat these sort of on par. And this one doesn't inflate. Like, I mean, Bitcoin does have inflation, right? But it doesn't have it has like a fixed plan on it all, but it doesn't have like this unknown sort of inflationary aspect to it that fiat currency can have. I think like also like you see there's yield in crypto too and Bitcoin as well. Like you can earn interest on your Bitcoin. I mean, I remember talking to the guys at BlockFi about this. When they opened up that Bitcoin interest account, they had a lot of people that were coming to them specifically going like, oh, so I can buy Bitcoin and then I can lend it out and I can get this yield. And they weren't even drawn to it necessarily from that first like initial, like, oh, like this is like something that's free from fiat currency. It was more like, oh, like I can own this and this like gets yield. And like, I think this has underlying value that will sort of like stick to it. So I would not be surprised if that actually has some sticking power to pull some people into that asset class as well. And like, look, like you can roll GBTC and just make like 15-20% a year anyway. Like that's not a bad trade. And like people are going to see that. And you've seen huge inflows move into that specifically like on that trade. So yeah, I don't know. I think like that trend's, they're very much going to continue. But I'm just like, I'm bid all risk assets like through all this. Like there's going to be some nonsense through the like election. There's no way there's not. But like you zoom out on this thing, like I don't see how this trend slows down at all. Like, I don't see any end in sight for, like, this sort of increasing of liquidity and, like, also just inflation in, like, risk asset prices. And, like, in that, I very much include Bitcoin.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned something there, Dan M., about, yield, Bitcoin yield. And I know that Raul Powell has talked about this in last month's GMI newsletter. He called Bitcoin pristine collateral and the, you know, talked about the future development of a yield curve on Bitcoin as collateral. Dan, I saw you tweet about this, Dan T. and you called, you know, you referenced the pristine collateral quote from Raul, and you also had called it in another tweet impossibly perfect collateral. Can you talk about that idea as Bitcoin as collateral, and how you see it developing in terms of yield on posting Bitcoin as collateral?
Oh, yeah, I mean, look, I love BlockFi's business. I think the yield thing is great. It's a bonus. In fact, I think it was a week or two ago, they are partnering with Paxos on Pax Gold and offering 4%. And I think in the next few years, you'll have, you know, not every, again, I have a physical gold business that I started 10 years ago, and we sell and store physical gold. I think, though, and I'm also a holder, I think that there's, you know, there's some portion of people's portfolios that they'll be, you know, maybe happy. I don't think they'll move all their physical gold or maybe gold that they have in futures or GLD. But to be able to pick up 4% with a Pax Gold token, lending that out on BlockFi, I mean, I think that's a huge innovation. You know, part of the reason I love this space, I mean, what I call the digital asset ecosystem, there's real innovation going on. I think, you know, you're taking a little bit more risk than if you just have it, you know, in a vault in Zurich. There is a little bit of credit risk, but I 4% is a lot, you know, a lot. So that was just to address something Dan M mentioned. I'm also excited about that, the beginning of these yield curves, as they say, as Raul said. In terms of pristine collateral, I mean, look, I think that, you know, gold is a pristine collateral. Not quite as pristine as Bitcoin, but gold, you know, is considered a AAA piece of collateral. It's, you know, it's large and liquid, et cetera. But, you know, I think Bitcoin is a lot more than gold, because gold is a store of value. And I think it's fantastic as that. And if you have a big portfolio, you should have 5 to 10% in it. But Bitcoin is a lot more than just a store of value. You know, it's this security apparatus. It's the monetary protocol for the internet, or at least I think it will be. You know, Jack Dorsey recently said, you know, he thinks by 2030, everyone transacting everything will be on, you know, on the internet will be on Bitcoin. And whether it is Bitcoin or on Bitcoin, or whether, you know, not every transaction needs such incredible security, and other sort of let your chains develop. It's sort of unclear. I mean, certainly Bitcoin, and I know Swan's very focused just on Bitcoin, but is the most important asset. Yes, it's a store of value, but again, it's this security mechanism for the, you know, for all things of value on the internet. Now, what's that worth? I mean, I've talked about that. That's, I mean, and how much would it cost to actually build that scratch if you had to? I mean, it's trillions of dollars. And so, you know, when Paul Tudor Jones says Bitcoin is the fastest horse, I think that's right. I think Bitcoin does outperform gold. I think, you know, it's certainly $5 trillion. It's at $200 billion now. In the next 10 years. And it's because it is pristine collateral, you know, the scarcity, all of that that we know. But for me, that value of a sort of this truth machine that I talk about, this almost self-levitating security apparatus, I mean, it's genius. So, yeah, I undersell Bitcoin often. You know, I don't want to get too crazy people to think, you know, he's lost it a little bit. But, you know, that's how I see it. What can I tell you?
But isn't that part of the problem, though? Like, not just, it's very, it's like an interesting point that you just said that, Dante, about like how you don't want people to like get this thought process on you, like sort of that, like that, that stigma still very much sits with it. And I think that is like in itself, like one of the issues that comes up with it as collateral, right? Is like people judge it on it. And it's like, we're still not past that stage. Sorry, it was just a point I wanted to make. You probably didn't even realize you were making it.
Yeah, I think it's very early. And, you know, I think that the fact that the language that we use to describe what Bitcoin is still, I mean, it's, I don't want to say it's confused, but like Bitcoin's value is different things to different people. It just shows you how early it is. It hasn't even, you know, and forget about then discuss Ethereum and some of the other things, you know, that are maybe less pristine, but, you know, and that are more experimental. Without even getting into them, because they're not, I would say, as clear macro assets. But even Vitalik, in one of these recent interviews, said, yeah, you know, Ethereum is more experimental, whereas Bitcoin is not, you know. I think that's important. It's not to take away from these other things, but Bitcoin has become a macro asset, in my view. And that's part of the reason why you see some of the correlation going up, because there are all kinds of traders and hedge fund guys and all, you know, that are trying to trade Bitcoin off of little macro events here and there. And, you know, I'm not really too focused on the squiggles. And so that, you know, that correlation is only short term. The asset's gone up. We looked at it the other day. It's up 236% annualized for the last 10 years. That to me doesn't have a correlation with anything ever in the history of financial markets, or really in the history of assets. So, anyway, I try to, I've got to hold back. You know, sometimes you get a little too excited.
It's all right. We like to get bullish here. I'll just say, you know, for viewers, especially, you know, our newer people newer to Bitcoin, I know that, you know, we have quite a few watching, as, you know, Swan brings in customers who are new to Bitcoin all the time, and they watch the show to kind of figure out what's going on. You know, when you do, you know, put Bitcoin into a yield producing product like BlockFi, you know, it's, you are taking risks, of course, and you should make sure you educate yourself on those risks. If you're looking for a Bitcoin based loan, you could go to a company like Unchained Capital, and they'll, you know, you can put your Bitcoin into a multi-signature account where you still hold one of the keys that are required to spend that money. So you can see that your collateral is safe in there. There's a lot to research there, but, watch for risks and do your own research.
Go ahead. Like, things have an interest rate for a reason. Like, it's exactly. Not, like, no one's just giving it to you so for no reason. So, like, keep that in the back of your mind. Like, there's always a cost there. And, like, there's non-zero risk. But, no, it's a good point to bring up, especially people getting into this new. Especially in crypto in particular, and, like, there's just a lot of traps because it is, like, it's just free and you can interact with anyone and anywhere in the world, and like that can open things up for exploits. So always be careful and vigilant.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I'd love to talk a little bit more about this, you know, the macro environment here. And Dan T has been posting some good stuff. And you should definitely follow Dan on Twitter at DTAPCAP. He posts some great analysis. There's one here that stood out to me in your recent tweets, and it's about excess liquidity in the market. It's reached, you know, an insane level in terms of like past excess liquidity levels, against the S&P 500 index. What does this mean to you? Like, what's going to happen to this excess capital? Where is it going to go? I know that you're, you know, bullish on residential real estate, bearish on commercial real estate, et cetera. Where do you think this money goes?
You know, I'm sorry, I missed a little bit of that question there. I think you were chiming in and out.
Okay. Yeah, I was asking about this chart that you post on Twitter. That's okay. This chart that you post on Twitter about excess liquidity. It's at an all-time high against
the S&P. Oh, you mean the M2?
Yeah.
The M2 chart?
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, so as a macro hedge fund manager and portfolio manager, you know, for over 20 years, you know, you spend most of your time looking at data and trying to understand data and what that means for the future of the markets. And, you know, trends in data sometimes start earlier than trends in markets. That's why, you know, Twitter for me is like, it's like a diary of some of the things that I look at, and I'm looking at all this stuff for my own portfolio. And, you know, you find something that really sticks out, that's really interesting. And, you know, I sort of macro nuggets, my analysts, you know, used to be, I always used to say they're digging for nuggets, almost gold nuggets, but just digging for nuggets. And that chart just shows you how extreme the situation is. It's the M2 year over year increase that for the last sort of 20 years we've been in this zero to call it 10% range. And then all of a sudden the chart has gotten destroyed, meaning that it, you know, it's moved to a new realm. And it's so extreme and so different from everything in the last 30 years, you know, which is the length of my career, it's forcing me to say to myself, I have to think about everything that I think about or that I have thought about in a new framework. I'm not exactly 100% sure what that framework is, but you know, if I thought that liquidity drove markets, and this is something, you know, Druckenmiller talks a lot about, you know, measures of liquidity and changes in liquidity, then this is, you know, a 3x or a 5x, you know, because you have not just the U.S. Being this aggressive, you have the whole world. I mean, look at what happened up in Canada. I mean, they've had a fraction of the cases in COVID we had, but they've ejected their central bank balance sheet, I think, is up 500% to ours, which is up, I think, only 100. I think it was the central bank balance sheet. Anyway, the point is you have the whole world doing this. And so that chart, it's breaking you into a new world. And so I think that certain assets can go to places that people can't imagine, you know, gold to, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 in the next 5 years. You know, Bitcoin can go to, you know, 200,000 to 300,000 plus. You know, the equity market can go up still quite a lot more over the next 5 years. And so I think we're really entering a period that's like, could be, you know, the booming 20s kind of thing. And again, I'm not, I think about sort of the next 5 years. As I said, I'm a little unsure in the short term, the next 6 months, but that liquidity, yeah, residential real estate, I mean, I think you'll probably have a housing boom that's bigger than anything we've ever seen. You know, throw the millennials in there and borrowing at 2%. Commercial real estate is a problem for a while. I guess what I'm saying really is that I think that there are areas that are going to develop and grow in the next 5 years that we're not quite aware of just yet. And it's because that money will go somewhere. And I don't think it just stays in bonds at a year, at a zero yield. You know, I wish I could be more specific for some of your listeners. What I will say is that every time I find myself thinking the way that I used to, I stop myself. And I think that's the old framework. Get yourself out of that, you know? Mm-hmm. And part of the way I do that is by throwing myself more into the Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, digital asset world. You know, reading or engaged on Twitter and conversations, just learning more and more, because I do think that this world is growing up side by side with the legacy world, and that at some point there'll be, you know, I don't want to say a switchover, but I do think that it's going to become much more prominent. Yeah, much more, much bigger. So
yeah, Dan M, you know, there's, so we have this excess liquidity on the sidelines, historic levels. Another chart that Dan T posted and I pulled out to talk about is shows that those aged 55 and over own 75% of U.S. equities in 2020, right? That figure was 52% in 1990. Meanwhile, right now, the under 40s hold just 4% of the equities in the United States, which is an absolutely astounding difference. You know, there's a generational divide here, clearly, in asset accumulation, wealth accumulation. The millennials have suffered one of the, you know, historically in the United States, the worst generation in terms of like economic performance through their, you know, early earning years. Does this like reality indicate to you for the futures of equities versus crypto, which, you know, is in the industry that seems like you are placing, you know, your bets on in terms of career and I'm sure investments?
Yeah, definitely got that bet on. So I think that pretty much just tells you the pace at which like assets have just grown relative to wages for, I don't know, 30, 40 years. I'm sure Dinty's got some great like stats on it. But like, I mean, like the end result is the asset prices have moved so much higher, faster, that you just kept falling further and further behind if you already didn't have some level of like wealth or some assets that you could like sort of accrue value on. So I think that's like the big separator there, right? Now, obviously you can't take your assets with you when you pass on. So like that wealth has to move down and back generations. It'll probably just happen a little bit later in the life of like that generation. But I don't know. I mean, I think there's like a real argument there. I don't think this means anything in any short duration. Like this is like a longer thing, but like there's clearly a demand for Bitcoin amongst this generation, right? Like there was that great, I think it was Charles Schwab or Fidelity put out that chart, right? Of like the top holdings, like of GBTC by age. And it was like all skewed, like basically 35 under. And that to me is just saying that there'll be a rotation into Bitcoin. Like that like asset class rotation will like most likely happen at some level. And right, you're taking something that's huge and you're like pushing into like a much smaller asset class. So like they're going to like level out, but you'll get so much more of a multiple on the one that obviously has to like catch up to the larger one. I don't know if that like doesn't really matter in the short term, right? Like this isn't like something that's happening like overnight. But I do think it's going to like cause some more social angst, right? Like if we do get this like housing boom, which like I actually kind of buy that entire thesis that this money's got to like rush into the system somehow, and you're going to keep sort of pricing out an entire generation, that doesn't like really sit very well, right? Like there's going to be people that like continue to like opt out of the system, or just like priced out of it like indefinitely. But as it pertains to Bitcoin, like, yeah, I think that's like a huge bullish narrative that's going to like stick out the back. Like it's always going to be there, but I don't let that like dictate sort of like shorter durational trading activity.
Yeah, fair enough. Dan T, what are your thoughts on this generational divide in wealth accumulation?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's integrally tied in with Bitcoin and the digital asset ecosystem. I mean, look, the younger people have a much greater facility, with technology. And I mean, look, if you believe it or not, I mean, in high school, my senior year, I wrote my history thesis in pencil, okay? I mean, on paper. So, because there was no, you know, there was nothing to, it wasn't until I got to college that you had the Mac. And so anyway, the point is that, you know, look, I think the generational shift is it's woven into the Bitcoin adoption thesis. I think, look, anyone over 50, certainly over 55, 60, has a hard time with Bitcoin. They just can't conceive of it. And I've spoken to many, many people in that age category, and under 40, even if you're not in the financial business, I think get it. There's just something intuitive about, yeah, I mean, of course this makes sense. Like, why hasn't this existed already? So I think the big shift happens, Dan M., I think the big shift happens when guys who are 35 now in the next 10 years become the heads of the Norwegian oil fund. Or, you know, the guy around 40, 45, you get younger guys moving into important positions in that big institutional allocation world. And I think they'll start to, you know, they'll start to move into it. I work on an investment committee for an endowment. And, you know, I was able to convince the committee to put 1% of the overall endowment into Bitcoin and a little Ethereum, too. The point is that, you know, those are older guys. They're very thoughtful. They thought about it. You know, 1% is not a crazy, you know, allocation. It's a toe dip. And again, I'm sort of in the middle. I'm that Gen X. And so it starts with, you know, Wences's, you know, just get off zero, go to 1%. And Wences is about my age. So it's that, you know, it's that group. The next group is going to be, you know, they're managing the Fidelity Fund, you know, guy 10 years from now. And he, you know, and he's going to say, well, we got to have 5% in, or we got to have 10%, or, you know, whatever it is. So that's another beautiful thing about this is, you know, the wind really is at your back. And because the millennials have not grown up in this equity culture, their first instinct is not to allocate to equity. Their first instinct is, okay, let's look at the options. I've been screwed a few times before. I couldn't get a job after 08 for 3 or 4 years. And, you know, it just, you know, I COVID again. I mean, there were a lot of things that have hit that generation. And so that's made them, you know, question what is the best allocation for them. And Bitcoin fits right in there. So I do think really tightly connected. Look, for me, I'm a little this. But people 10 and 15 years younger than me are thinking about, and there's no better way. And the talent in the space is much higher than in any other space that I've seen. Just the raw intellectual capability, entrepreneurship, desire to make money. I mean, the true capitalists are in this space. They're not really, I mean, under the age of 35. They're not really in the hedge fund business. They're not really guys, I don't think, working at, you know, the third old guy working at Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley. Those are super traditional organizations that are not on the cutting edge. You're not going to be able to make a killing like you can make in this space if you're focused and paying attention.
Yeah, Dan, let's go over to you. So you have been working in this space. You're one of those, you know, the big major talents of your generation that's moved into crypto and Bitcoin, and this is where your career has been. You worked with the early team at Kraken. You obviously ran the trade desk at Circle. You've got your own holding company now. The trading and liquidity infrastructure of Bitcoin has come a long way, you know, in the past, well, you know, 10 years since there was literally no trading infrastructure, in the pre-Coinbase days with Mt. Gox and the other just, you know, very unprofessional exchanges. That's professionalized over time. And it's gotten to the point in the last couple of years that there are trusted exchanges, you know, to the point where and liquidity providers to the point where, you know, someone like Michael Saylor can trust to come into the space and you know, deal in Bitcoin, you know, in a professional manner. So you've been in the space and seen this happen. Can you talk about the evolution from, you know, to this kind of more professional trading and liquidity infrastructure that we have now in Bitcoin?
Yeah, totally. And like I was saying, I didn't have any great foresight that any of this would get to where it is. I just took a pretty big risk pretty early on, in particularly just going to work for Kraken, though I would like sort of drifted into moving this thing as my career choice. probably around like late 2012, early 2013. So like I've seen a lot. I was like sort of seeing the evolution. I've seen a lot of bad, seen a lot of good happen. But it's actually interesting you brought up the Saylor thing because, I mean, he bought what? All in, I think it was like a $400, $450 million worth of Bitcoin. It doesn't really matter the exact amount, but there's not really a super noticeable market impact on that, right? Like you can't like look at the chart and be like, oh, that's where he bought it. It's clear, right? And that's wild. Like that is a very large notional to move through in like a very pretty short time frame, like relatively. And the market was able to like source that liquidity for him. So like that's a big step forward to where it's getting. So in terms of how this has really evolved, like the big thing that's like changed is everything used to be spot, right? Like everything was a spot transaction, like dollars, Bitcoin, swap them. Like that's how it all happened. Like the exchange sat as the intermediary on the whole thing. They were of marginal quality, especially in the beginning of like trustworthiness. And it was like getting it out. Like maybe you can like keep a little on there and like provide liquidity if you're looking at like a little scratch on the trading side. But like in general, these things were super toxic. Like they were going down every other month. And you were like, it was really something you had to do and you weren't like super looking forward to it. That's changed. Like the custodians, the exchanges, they're a lot more trustworthy. That being said, like Bitcoin's great in that you don't have to trust anybody if you don't want to. So if you really have no reason to keep that custody with those exchanges if you don't, which is like a very important point to make. But that being said, like you can now like sort of keep real balances with these places. There's real trading desks that are like operating this. Like every large Chicago prop shop has like an arm on this thing where they're like pumping liquidity into the markets. And futures got really liquid, right? Like CME in particular was like a turning point because that was a traditional market sort of not blessing it, but saying that like we think this is warranted enough to give access to all of our clients to trade. And I think that was like a really big point for a lot of traditional liquidity providers that normally were like, look, like this exchange sits in a domicile that I'm not super happy about. I have to fully collateralize this thing and I got to keep a lot of exposure to it. And I don't really understand what my risk profile looks like because my collateral can just be yanked out from me at any given point in time to something where they're like, all right, like we can trade this. We get this. It sits in our risk systems. We get CME. We get like our FCM. Like this is a model that makes sense to us. And the liquidity has gotten really good. And now you have like a lot of offshore venues offering derivatives to like Fobi and OKX. Like OKX has been doing it forever. You got like FTX, you got BitMEX, you have with Deribit. There's a lot of venues now where you can get real access to margin and liquidity. And that has made it possible for things like what Saylor did, where you can go into the market and like grab half a yard, 100 sticks of like risk and like not just move the market indefinitely or have to do it in the spot market, which is super expensive and can like really like bully the price around. So it's night and day. Like this is like not even a recognizable world from 4 or 5 years ago. This was an unfathomable thing that you could be like moving this kind of size in and out and that you could like have access to like this sort of liquidity. It's still bad though. Like I'm not saying that this is like, oh, like we did it. It's finally fixed. Like it's still not great. And it's not great because all of these venues you have to collateralize independently, right? Like if I have Bitcoin on Coinbase, I can't like trade against the price on Bitstamp or I can't access liquidity on BitMEX. Like they're all disjointed. There's no like real prime structure where like you can access all the different markets at any given time, but you have to collateralize every one of them at the same given time. And it makes what like what we do very difficult, but it's also like one of the reasons we have like a role in the market is that we're sort of shifting all those flows around and like keeping things like sort of tight and efficient. But that shows like where like the market is still very niche. Like that's very small. Like that's a solved problem in like larger and mature markets that we just like really haven't gotten to yet. So there's still a good deal of work that has to get done, but it's very liquid now. And it's a real testimony of like the entrepreneurs that like moved into the space and like took a lot of risk and like built a lot of things that didn't really make sense at the time, right? Like if you were at Kraken in 2013, I could tell you, even if you had all the trading activity in the world at that point, the business didn't make sense. Like you weren't going to ever make enough money to like justify it. You had to like have this belief that like the asset class was going to grow tremendously and like the trading volumes would grow and this is going to be a much bigger thing. And like it really sort of worked out and like for that vision. And even when we were running the OTC desk at first, when I were at Circle, like if we would trade like $5 or $6 million a day in the beginning, we'd be like, wow, this is great. Like, this is like crazy. Like, I can't believe there's $5 million worth of Bitcoin like exchanging hands with us. And then by like the peak, we were doing like $300-400 million like in a 24-hour span. And I was like, this is bonkers. Like, this is huge. Like, this is like unfathomable that you could like ever have this much like notional moving around. So like, it's really, really grown on that side. But like I said, there's still a ton to do though. This is not by any means like done.
Dan T, you are obviously a professional investor. What's been your experience with the development of Bitcoin's trading and liquidity infrastructure?
Well, I mean, look, I haven't been in it as long as Dan M. I mean, my introduction to it was through my gold company in 2014. We Gold Bullion International, GBI, integrated that year with a firm called BitReserve, which today is Uphold. And we were the first place that you could buy and sell physical gold to buy and sell Bitcoin and Ripple. That business took off. It actually still exists today. You know, liquidity was very tough back then. But I didn't really engage again until Q1 19. When the price had collapsed and it just, you know, I didn't participate in a real way, in the move up, in 17. And then I saw an opportunity when the price came down a lot. But I'm not in and out trading it. I allocated what I wanted to allocate at that in Q2, and that's it basically. And so, I for what I needed to do for DTAP Capital, liquidity is fine. I mean, I have it spread it out in 8 different places, and you know, I'm happy. You know, I'm happy with that. So I don't, I'm not in there trading it day to day and, you know, as sensitive to the liquidity issues that Dan M is. I would just say that for the rest of the world, though, for sort of the Bitcoin is still not that liquid. You know, there are entities out there that will take, $30-40 billion gold. You know, you can probably buy a few billion dollars, certainly in a day, easily. Again, 50 trillion annual volume, and so for the big money, Bitcoin is still too small. I mean, it's more of a novelty. But you know, I think that's changing, and as the market cap goes up, it'll of course change as well. And that's the way it is with all bull markets. Things always start at a low price. They're always liquid in the beginning. And the liquidity is always greatest at the very top. So I know we're nowhere near the top.
Good point. All right, Dante, we're going to start with you on this one. How do you think of gold compared to Bitcoin? Are they complements to each other, both as a hedge against fiat inflation, or are they competing against one another for that role?
Now, I think, and sort of the theme of the things I talk about on Twitter is like, you really should own both. You know, gold owners are the original hard money advocates. I think that, you know, Bitcoin people denigrating gold owners is kind of a mistake. I've said before, they're kind of like cousins. I think your first adopters amongst the institutional or just large pools of money are people who understand gold and understand that Bitcoin, one aspect of Bitcoin is that it's a form, you know, it's a digital form of hard money. So I think they are connected. You know, maybe, you know, over time, some people who might have bought gold had to buy Bitcoin. But I also think that they're own Bitcoin who might look at gold and say, well, you know, there are some interesting attributes to it. It is hard money and it is a hedge to the equity side of my portfolio. I don't think Bitcoin, I mean, it can act as a hedge, but I think Bitcoin is really doing its own thing. As I said, I mean, any asset up 230% annualized for 10 years in a row, I mean, is doing its own thing. So I don't really think that Bitcoin is a hedge to a institutional portfolio. I think it can act that way, but it's not as clean as gold. Also, look, there's some other attributes like owning a physical gold that are commonly known. I mean, first of all, physical gold is not pretty, so it has it's free of certain types of regulation. Gold, physical gold can be completely, you know, and Bitcoin is not completely. There's a record there of all the transactions. Companies like Chainalysis have gone on the deep dive. So that's another aspect of gold. There are also benefits in certain jurisdictions to owning certain types of gold. To get down in the weeds of physical gold, there, especially, globally, there are a lot of attributes. I mean, I've just made more of them, but I will say, people are saying, oh, gold's away. The network effect that exists is just something will take any asset a very long time to get to. Just think about this. I mean, any person anywhere in the world, whether they're in a desert or in the jungles in South America or in China, anywhere, they know the sun, they know water, they know food, and they know gold. Every person on this planet knows what gold is. And that's a very hard to dislodge. It's embedded in the psyche of human beings. Bitcoin maybe eventually can get there, but it's not getting there tomorrow. So I just, I think it's cutting edge. And as I think Bitcoin is really much more gold because it's itself a security apparatus, and it could be that, as I said, transactions of major value transactions, there's a decent chance that it will get done using Bitcoin or on the Bitcoin network in coming years. So I think, honestly, for someone today, if someone just asked me off the cuff, I think you have to have at least 1% in Bitcoin, at least fivefold. If you're a little younger, I mean, maybe it's, 10% in Bitcoin and, 7% in gold. I don't know what it is, but I think you have to have it. And that's sort of the first stage. Right. One last thing I would say, and I don't think Bitcoiners are often aware of this, is that really don't own any gold yet. It's globally, I think it's like 1-2% of institutions own gold. And so I think that this is just the beginning of a bull market in gold. And I've said other places, I did an interview in February or March, I sort of hypothesized that this is the first real bull market in gold, because gold is going to become used as a proxy for cash or cash plus duration, which would be bonds. And we've never seen that before. Bonds have never been this unattractive versus gold ever. And so I think the first wave of capital that's coming in will come into gold first, or in bigger size into gold. I know it's almost funny because Bitcoin people think gold is more prominent than it is. It's not really, it's not in the traditional world. It's not really considered part of the asset allocation mix. So that's another reason why it's still very early in Bitcoin, early for Bitcoin, because after they've bought the gold, I think then they're more amenable to Bitcoin. And that's among older people, too. I would say it's easier for younger people to go straight to Bitcoin because they probably don't have the liquidity problem that you,
Yeah.
If you're an institution. So.
Right, right. Dan M., do you hold gold or are you all Bitcoin in your, in terms of your hard money assets?
I'm goldless, but that's not any, like, I would be a gold holder. I just am more tied to the Bitcoin side of it. That being said, like, I think the Venn diagram of, like, those two pools of people is, like, pretty overlapping. Like, I think there's a lot of noise that gets made about it. I think Bitcoin as a community in general tries to, like, tie to being, like, a better version of gold or, like, gold 2.0 or whatever, like, digital gold, like, whatever, like, the narrative is. Because gold's so valuable, right? Like, it's like, oh, like, we want to get to that level. Like, this is something, like, we should be sort of pushing. So if anything, it's like, I don't know, what's the saying? Like, you know, you copy something is, like, the greatest form of flattery or something like that. But not that it's copying it, but, like, you're just sort of trying to tie yourself into it. So I think that's the big aspect going on there. That being said, I think the big difference between the two of them in particular is there's a ton of legwork you have to do to, like, really sort of get yourself familiar and operating or really wrap your head even around Bitcoin. I think it's a lot harder to take as a stepping stone versus, like, gold, which is, like, sort of just innately taught to you, like, from a child, like, oh, this is, like, valuable, like, pirates want it kind of thing, right? Like, it's just, like, it's part of, like, cultural lore. It's been around, like, since people have really been around. That's, like, a lot easier to just, like, wrap your head around initially versus, like, oh, so there's 21 million of these and they're mined and, like, every block's 10 minutes and, like, this is how you, like, get a wallet. You know, like, that is a big burden on somebody to, like, pick up out of the gate. And I think that's why you probably see a skewing a lot of times towards people who are very technically savvy or people who are younger and, like, have time to, like, pick it up as who get into that as opposed to, like, gold, which is just a much larger, broader sort of community. I mean, the gold's been around forever. It's got that on it, like, that matters a ton. But I don't know, I don't find them to be communities that are in conflict as much as I think gets pushed as a narrative out there.
Yeah, I hear that, man. I too am goldless at the moment, but I have been looking closer at it as especially in this macroeconomic environment.
So I looked into this because I was like, how would you get a gold bar if you really wanted to do it? And I put the question on Twitter and I got a ton of crazy answers. But a couple of friends of mine actually gave me a real answer to sort of do it. I haven't done it though, but I do want to, like, take that ride. I want to see how, like, you
see it. It's very
it goes the other way too, Dan.
I mean, it's very easy. I mean, that's why I founded, co-founded GBI in 2000. You know, it was late 08, early 09, was to make it very easy for people to own physical in the best possible way and also to hold that outside the banking system. I mean, there are only one or two places that I remember back then outside of the banks. I thought, well, you're owning gold is a risk to banking systemic risk. Why would you ever hold your physical gold at JP Morgan or Morgan? It just didn't make any sense to me. And so, you know, that's why we founded GBI. And, you know, we store in seven vaults around the world. We lease space from Brinks and Loomis. I think we're sort of the highest quality institutional provider in the space. And institutional just meaning, white glove. And so, and on pricing, I think we're very good too. I mean, I think it really is easy, but, you know, if we haven't reached people like you, we still are on marketing. And the company, frankly, has been really more of a technology and ops company because we built this platform and we integrate with other firms that have distribution. So as an example, if you had an account at Merrill Lynch, if you were, if you had a financial advisor, again, this traditional world, $3 trillion in assets at Merrill Lynch Wealth Management, you know, 15,000 FAs, if you wanted a bar of gold and you wanted it stored in Singapore, your Merrill FA would just call up his system and sort of push his button, and then that's us. We built that platform for them, and then we've white labeled that business to a whole bunch of other clients, and we also own direct to consumer businesses. So I don't know. We are doing our best effort to make it easy for you, Dan M, but I guess we haven't, We haven't done it well enough. So still some more work to do there. Yeah,
it goes both ways, though. People get into gold and they find Bitcoin because of the ideas of sound money. It goes the other way, too. People get into Bitcoin, the ideas of sound money lead them to the, you know, to gold. So, yeah, it goes both ways. And maybe Bitcoin will supplant gold as pirate money at some point here in the future.
I didn't mean that. I feel like that's taken out of context. I didn't mean that, like, in jest. Yes, I just, like, it's like every child knows about it, right? Like, it's just ingrained, right? You get where I'm coming from with the whole thing.
I totally get it. I just had to jab there.
No, I know that's like the clip that's going to get like played now. And it's like,
all right. Well, this has been a fantastic discussion, guys. I knew this would be a fun pair. You can follow Dan M or Dan T at DTAPCAP, DTAPCAP. You can follow Dan M at CMS Holdings on Twitter. Swan Bitcoin is at Swan Bitcoin. We do have daily buys coming soon. We have weekly buys. We've had great demand for us to move to daily buys. You can catch those dips even better. And, you know, accumulating Bitcoin slowly over time with the dollar cost averaging strategy has proven to be the most effective method to accumulate Bitcoin and establish a good cost basis for 99% of people, all the non-professional traders out there. Speaking of making it easy to acquire, we make acquiring Bitcoin as easy as possible, as safe as possible at Swan Bitcoin. So go to swanbitcoin.com/Satoshi and you'll get $10 of Bitcoin dropped into your account when you start stacking Swan. Okay, guys. Thank you so much to Dan and Dan. It was a lot of fun. We're out. Take care out there. Thanks to Dan T and Dan M for joining us. You can find Dan T on Twitter at DTAPCAP, DTAPCAP, and Dan M at CMS Holdings. I am at Citizen Bitcoin, and you'll find Swan at Swan Bitcoin. On behalf of the Swan team, thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Swan Signal Podcast. It's fun to join us live on the YouTube broadcast at youtube.com/SwanSignal. Head over there, subscribe, turn on the notifications. We have a lot of fun in the live chat, and we often work in some questions from listeners. Daily buys are coming soon to Swan. Get in the beta group at swanbitcoin.com/dailybuys. Swan Signal is a production of Swan Bitcoin at swanbitcoin.com, the best way to accumulate Bitcoin with automatic recurring buys.